This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 13th of July 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 262 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll meet the author Maria Venegas, whose new memoir recounts her reunion with her estranged father 14 years after he shot and killed their neighbour.
Also ahead, we meet the director of the Design Awards that recognise design that's changed the world around us for 90 years.
And before the end of the programme, we'll speak to one of the founding members of one of the world's leading silent theatre companies. That's if she talks.
All that plus and news look ahead and some great music too right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. It's a studio chat here, Andrew, in the script. What do you reckon to that?
Well, I'm just a bit concerned that we're going to have an interview with a mime artist. I hope she says something.
I might do the rest of the show just doing mime. Okay. Just in mime. Let's pull down the fourth wall.
Now, we had a nice week last week, yep. You and me. Up in the mountains, there was a lot of people. We went to Bolzano for the launch of the Sud Tyrol or South Tyrol or Alto Adige. If you want to say it?
Everything in three languages.
Yeah,
we've got
it in three languages. Yep. Survey, which is in the current issue of Monocle.
And what a beautiful part of the world it is! And don't they know how to throw a party?
What an amazing party! We had an outdoors party, really beautiful summer's night.
Yeah,
and Bolzano is really interesting. But it's funny. It's like you're
it
in
is,
Italy.
Really, it is there.
In Italy,
it's
everyone's speaking. Lots of people are speaking German, and it's kind of really Tyrolean. And it's a bit of Italy that was once part of Austria, got given to the Italians after the First World War. And it's just funny how everyone is so accidentally really international. They speak multiple languages just through a fate of history.
And it's a gorgeous place. Also, we were lucky. It's a good place to throw a party because it seems like all their wine producers, all their beer producers, all their food producers seem to have the most tip-top amazing stuff you could possibly imagine. I think the Furst... Did you have any of that beer on draft during the party?
I was.
You're a wine man.
Yeah, wine man.
That was the nicest beer I literally have ever had. Fact. Honestly, it's the nicest beer I've ever tasted by miles. It's the most amazing thing. It must be the water. I don't know what it is. I think beers. Apparently, good beer is all about, like, good pizza. Good beer is all about the water with which you make it.
And there was a lot of Aperol Spritz as well.
There was quite a lot of Aperol Spritz. When everyone... Exactly. It was quite a rowdy party, wasn't it, actually?
Yes, it was good. Very good.
He's closing that one down.
As I said to you when we got back to London, how does it feel to be the person who was the best behaved on a trip?
I know. Our times have changed for the better, right? It's good.
But for that, we both came back like adults. Very strange.
Exactly.
Anyway.
Exactly. With all the buttons on our trousers and everything.
Done up as well.
Yeah.
Anyway. It's time. I think, for the little one.
Is it news time?
Yes.
Here he comes, strutting down the corridor. I can see him through the plate glass window to my left. It's Daniel Giacopelli with his news look ahead. And here he is. Daniel Giacopelli joins us for the news look ahead. Danny, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
What about Andrew? It's this show too.
Yeah, I've invited you as well. Don't be rude.
Thanks very much, Andrew.
Okay, that's all right. So you've got a very nice long list here of things to look ahead at. Mm. Where are you going to begin?
Indeed. Well, I think we can't avoid the World Cup final, which takes place
only
hours away.
Neither do I think we should. Yep.
Argentina and Germany. Who's going to win?
Germany.
Well, I don't know anything about football, so I can't tell you.
Just pick one. Nobody knows anyway.
Oh, Argentina. Definitely.
Ooh, controversial.
I went there earlier this year.
Okay.
Yeah, I quite like Argentina.
Okay. Hoping for a freebie there. What about you, Danny?
I think Germany's going to win.
No, I'm sure Germany will win. Look, they whooped poor old Brazil. Did you feel sorry for the Brazilians in our building on Monday? Was it Monday, Tuesday?
It was Thursday. It was Wednesday.
Wednesday.
Yeah.
I didn't feel sorry for them on Monday either, but I did feel sorry for them on Wednesday.
We were giving regular updates on the Monocle Daily about how it was going, and we were just astounded.
It was ridiculous.
Goal. I mean, it was just...
I went to the pub, watched it, went for a wee, came back two goals later.
Yeah,
it wasn't even that long away.
Well, our Fernando Augusto Pacheco, he went back to Brazil for the World Cup. I'm not sure he's going to return.
No,
I think he's a bit ashamed.
With his tail
National
between
morning.
His legs.
So anyway, that's at 8 o'clock UK time tonight. So I'm sure we'll all tune in. Well, what else is happening? There's a Grand Sumo tournament taking place next week. In fact, a week from today in Nagoya. In Japan.
So is this just, what is this? Is this a sort of final of sorts?
One of six Grand Sumo tournaments this year. So there's six of them. They're competing for the title of Yokozuna or Grand Champion. I've never actually been to a sumo.
No, I haven't been to a sumo competition. I mean, sometimes in Selfridges you do get a sort of feel of it when there's a large man in the changing room next to you. But I think that's about as near as I've got to a benappied large man.
I think they're struggling to get people to enter the sport these days, and I think there's a bit of controversy around that too.
Oh well, lots of the people now come from
Hawaiian,
Mongolia, Bulgaria.
Bulgaria.
Yeah, they've got a few Eastern Europeans.
Oh, really?
That seems a bit.
Yeah. West, I think you should look the part.
West Sussex.
Come on, I'm letting myself go that much, Andrew. So that's good. Yeah,
that's happening.
That's a big TV event as well.
It seems to be
a very big TV. You need a really wide screen.
Oh dear.
Getting up early to get on everyone, Andrew Tuck, don't you?
Are you into fencing, Andrew?
No.
Okay. Well, on Wednesday is the World Fencing Championships in Russia.
How quickly do you have to put the fence up?
Oh, man. Someone wheel him off.
He's here all night.
Pick it.
Bar mitzvahs, weddings.
Yeah, exactly.
It's taking
Andrew needs his own theme tune, I think.
In Kazan, Russia, since 1937, they've been having this. I'm looking forward to it.
Fencing's excellent. I did do it for a tiny bit at school.
Did you?
Fencing, yeah. It was really useful later in life. We also did basketball, which was completely ridiculous.
Do you prefer epi or saber?
Saber.
Okay. Would you go for an epi or a saber?
I don't know what epi means.
I think
Danny, really, I just say there's two categories.
I just don't like the accent agu on the epi.
You don't like that?
Yeah,
I don't understand.
You can have a woman's epi.
Epi.
Or a woman's saber. It was introduced in 1989, I see here. Anyway, there you go.
I should also add...
Have you got a foil to that story? maybe on a more serious note.
On Thursday, gentlemen, is the Ernest Hemingway lookalike contest in Florida.
This is an annual...
This is actually a fabled event in Florida.
Is it?
Fabled?
No, it really is. In Key West, where Papa used to kind of fish and tell stories about the marlins he didn't catch. They have, around the world, people go every year, and they show off their beards, and they try to compete for the person who looks most like Ernest Hemingway.
I think in that picture, the man on the bottom right looks like the man kissing the other man.
Yeah, so I have a picture here of they're getting a bit friendly. But it's quite, I mean, you know, for all every 19-year-old American boy loves
Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah. And this is kind of a fun event for that. I mean, it's hosted by Sloppy Joe's Bar, which is a Hemingway-related drinking hole.
Where isn't? I mean, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Harry's Bar.
Yeah, exactly. And I like the way they found their kind of Islands in the Stream era Hemingway there, I suppose. It's the fishing Hemingway rather than perhaps the young, it's not the sun also rises early Hemingway, is it?
No, nor is it the depressed Hemingway of... the mid-1950s.
Yeah. No, he's boozy, happy,
exactly.
Father Christmassy Hemingway.
Yes, nice. Telling tall tales to the Cubans who would listen to him.
Yeah.
Okay, should we give you one final one?
Do you want to hear about the Camel Racing Festival?
No,
the Salzburg Festival?
Camels.
Okay, fine. A week from today, next Sunday, Paris turns all of their riverside areas into
all of their riverside
Paris
areas?
Plage. The urban beaches open
in
France.
They do a little bit of it, I think, not the whole thing.
Well,
the Paris plage.
Yeah, exactly. I say Paris plage. That's how I say it.
I've
never actually seen this, but it looks kind of interesting. They used to do that on the Thames by Waterloo Bridge.
Yeah. I think they've kind of.
I think Paris went first. I think
did they?
Yeah. They beat us to it.
Oh, okay.
They're a bit kind of more welcoming.
So, urban beaches in Paris a week from today. Check it out.
Let's hope there's some decent weather for the Parisians, because there's nothing you want more than a sort of polka dot bikini containing only
sumo wrestlers.
Goosebumps or sumo wrestlers, exactly. That's the last thing we need. I think that was a really good news look ahead, and I presume from that news look ahead that we've approached the silly season. I can't wait to present one of the live news shows next week and for it to all be about things that are completely insignificant to the future of the world.
That's what I do as a producer.
Do you promise me that will be the case?
Full fluff.
Full fluff. That's only his middle name. Daniel Giacopelli, thank you very much for joining us with your news look ahead. The author Maria Venegas, who was estranged from her father for 14 years. He'd gone into hiding following the killing of a neighbour in Chicago before being extradited to Mexico on a murder charge. When she finally made the journey back from the US to her native Mexico, she found her father at the old hacienda where both she and he were born.
What she discovered in rekindling her relationship with her father was a life shaped by a stark and persistent undercurrent of violence. As they worked the land together, the stories he shared with her gave new light to the tumultuous relationship they'd had until that point. Well, Maria's recollections have just been published in the memoir Bulletproof Vest, The Ballad of an Outlaw and His Daughter. And I spoke to Maria a little earlier on this week.
The opening scene in the book, it's called Ambush, and for me, it made sense to start the book at that point and then take the reader from that moment back in time and bring them full circle to that moment and then up until when I reconciled with my father. But yeah, that happened in, I believe it was 1999. He was ambushed with two machine guns. And by then he'd been gone for a number of years and he was living back in Mexico on his ranch. And when I received the phone call, there was a certain amount of ambivalence. Because I didn't care whether or not he lived or died. And I think that was also maybe for me sort of a survival mechanism or a way of coping with his absence and his violence was to just cut him out of my life so completely that when that phone call did come that he was dead, I wouldn't care. He survived the ambush, luckily. And a number of years after that, I went back to Mexico to visit him. And I spent quite a bit of time with him on his ranch.
So the book is kind of about a reconciliation or a coming to knowing of your father in many senses, mm-hmm. and a man that you had many tales to tell. You know, an extraordinary past. I think you say in the book that one of his proudest moments, or his mother's proudest moments, was when he was 12 and he shot a man. Mm-hmm. Can you just tell us a little bit about your father's upbringing and you know, and the world that he lived in that you began to discover when you went back home?
And that's the thing is that when I went back to Mexico to see him again, to visit him, and at that point, you know, I was all grown up, I was an adult. Before that, when I was a kid, I always sort of felt that it was unfair that we had ended up with this lunatic for a father, because I didn't understand why he did the things that he did or why he'd come home from the taverns and shoot his gun off into the sky in the Chicago suburbs. You know, people used to call the police and then eventually they stopped. They got used to it. But when I went back to visit him in Mexico, he started sharing stories with me about his upbringing and his childhood. And I think that was his way of trying to explain to me why he had lived such a violent and self-destructive life. And in his sharing of those stories, for me, I started to write them out and to flesh them out. And initially, the book started off, I sort of wanted to write a book-length ballad or corrido about my father. And I really wanted to write a work of nonfiction that would read like a novel. So in recreating the stories that he shared with me, I came at them from different angles. I wrote some of those scenes in first person and then second person and switched them around. And then the ambush scene, I think, was the first scene I ever wrote in the third person. And that was really exciting because I felt like when I wrote that scene in third person, it finally clicked. And I felt like I had discovered the structure for the book itself, which, you know, it switches between first person and third person, between my perspective and my father's perspective.
And tell me about the genesis for this book, because this isn't something you've just written in the past few months. It feels like it's a book that's been a long time coming. And it started out as a piece in Granta as well?
Mm-hmm. Yes, in 2009, and it was excerpted in Granta, they published three of the pieces. And they all sort of play off each other. And that is very much the structure of the book. I feel like you could kind of pick it up and just open it to any chapter, and it's its own entity, and it reads from beginning to end as sort of a short story. But I would say the genesis was my wanting to write my father's story, and I very much wanted to write his story. And then once I sold the book, I had a conversation with one of my editors, and this is in the U.S., Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and he was like, well, you know, Maria, readers aren't going to relate to your father. They're going to relate to you being the daughter of this man. And so he very much said, you need to be in the book. And I never set out to write about myself. I never set out to write a memoir or anything like that. But I feel as if I got wrangled into the book.
Now, obviously, it's the story of yourself, as you say, and your father. But how much is this also a story of Mexico, of Mexicans moving to America, of desire for change and being caught up with history and being Mexican. How much is that reflected, do you think, in the book?
I don't know to what extent. I mean, obviously that's, you know, I'm a Mexican. I emigrated to the U.S. when I was 4 years old illegally. So, and my father went there illegally initially and then...
And was extradited back to Mexico on a murder charge.
He was extradited on a murder charge, yes. Before that happened, he left because he had shot and killed our neighbor in the Chicago suburbs. And then that man had two brothers that were asking questions around town. So my father bought himself a bulletproof vest, and that's where the name for the book comes from. And he carried on as he always had, continued going to the taverns, and then eventually he left. And he went back to Mexico, and he never came back. And then several years later, he resurfaced, and he was in Colorado. And then from there, he was extradited for murder back to Mexico. But, you know, I feel like whatever those topics, the immigrant topic, and if that comes up in the book, it's just woven into the story. It's not so much something that I'm trying to hit the reader over the head with. It's just a part of who I am. And very much as the same way as, unfortunately, the cartels come up in the book later. I think it's like book three. And that's because they literally drove into the town where my father was living. And I feel like they sort of crashed into my book, into the story.
The book obviously recounts a kind of understanding of your father and the, his journey and the many violent things that happened in his past and his complicated life and many other incidents. So there was a real life journey between you and your father to kind of reach a certain place. But does much of the understanding of your father then follow in subsequent years when you've been writing the book? Did your opinion of him continue to change? Was there a kind of understanding of him more when you began to put words on paper?
Absolutely. But I think my understanding of him really started when I went back to visit him that first time. Because at that point, I hadn't had a relationship with him for 14 years. And I thought that I would go back to Mexico and you know, look him in the eye. And that would be the end of it. And then, of course, he drove me to the bus station when I was leaving. And we had this moment where when we were saying goodbye and his chin started quivering. And I think for me, that was a changing moment. And I realized that he was vulnerable and that he was human and he wasn't just this big monster that we had all made him out to be. And so I went back after that. And certainly in writing and fleshing out the scenes and writing the stories that he had shared with me, it absolutely helped me to understand. And novelists say this all the time as well. They say, you know, you make discoveries in the writing. And even with nonfiction, I feel like I made a lot of discoveries in the writing process itself.
So tell us a little bit about your life then, how you manage, you know, you have this dad who's shooting his gun up into the sky at night, but here you are, you've written a book which I think everybody I've read or spoken to about it and says it's just a, you know, a masterpiece, it's an extraordinary piece of writing. Not difficult in the sense of the subject matter, but you know, you don't. It's not a kind of like I came to love my dad kind of story. There's much more. There's huge depth here. How did you become such an extraordinary writer? Well, I can say that. How did you become such a good writer?
Well, thank you for that. You know, I think for me, I had this attitude when I started to write the book. I felt like if I was going to go back and write about the past and rehash it, and to write about the past is to relive it. And it was a very painful and difficult past. And so I felt that if I was going to go back and write about it, I was going to at least try and make it worth my time, or I was going to try and make it more entertaining for myself or challenging. And so I really wanted to challenge myself to write a work of nonfiction that would read like a novel. So I read... you know, numerous novels and looked for and tried to really break it down and dissect the craft and see what those people were doing and how I could use that in my own writing. And William Faulkner was a huge influence.
And tell me today, you now live in New York. You have this great book already done. What happens next? Do you have another novel that you're working on? And is that connected with Mexico?
I have several short stories that didn't make it into the book, mainly because they didn't feed the overall narrative arch, but I think I would like to do a collection of short stories. That just seems like a sort of easy project to do coming off the book. And I very much want to write a novel, and I have this idea for a novel that's set in Mexico. It's interesting because, you know, we were on BBC this morning talking about bees, and And I think it's sort of in Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude, you've got the yellow butterflies. I want to do something along those lines, but it's got to do more with the honeybees than the butterflies. And I think it's set between the Yucatan and New York City.
But tell me, so what's interesting, the genesis for this book and for what you're talking about, that the short story can grow into a novel or can grow into a book of fiction. It's a starting point for you, that kind of shorter, you write something that may become connected to another story and find a link, or you may write something that sits on its own. But there seems to be a kind of, I think what's interesting for many of our listeners, I imagine, they think if they were ever to write a book, they would think, oh, I've got to write 100,000 words. Mm-hmm. But your approach to it is quite interesting, that you think, okay, I'll do something manageable and see where that takes me. That'll be the beginning of a journey.
Right. And you have to start somewhere. I think sometimes it can be really daunting to think I have to sit down and just write a masterpiece, or I'm going to sit down and write 100 words. That's a lot of pressure, I think, on anyone. So if you sit down and say, I'm just going to write a short story or just a few paragraphs.
Well, thank you. I think you've given lots of inspiration, but the most important inspiration is for people, obviously, to go out and read this book. It's called Bulletproof Vest, The Ballad of an Outlaw and His Daughter. Thank you very much indeed.
Art as a tool to fix our lives? Alain de Botton believes it is. Monocle Films meets the philosopher in the Rijks Museum in Amsterdam, where visitors are introduced to this new therapeutic look at art.
It's not therapy in the sense of, you know, three times a week on a couch. It's therapeutic in the very loose sense of the word. Sometimes in our own life, we're like up against our problems, we feel a bit claustrophobic. So a picture of a wide open view can for a moment just open our minds and open ourselves to better horizons.
Art is Therapy, now playing in the film section on Monocle.com.
All right, time for some new music now. This is from Luke Sittal Singh, who's a kind of fresh, folky kind of guy from the UK. This is his new single called Bottled Uptight. And that was nice. That was Bottled Uptight, new from Luke Sittal Singh. And if you can't wait for the album, good news, it comes out near the end of this year. It's called The Fire Inside.
The morning show for North America's East Coast is a pacey roundup of the day's main stories. The Briefing features informed news reporting, prescient business analysis, and invaluable industry reports from all around the world.
The protesters on the street are doing all of this in order to try and get the military to take over and to declare an emergency and basically start something that looks like a coup in order to get the current government out of power.
Each day we're joined by an expert. Monocle's correspondents and industry insiders are in studio for analysis of the aviation, technology, defence, media and luxury retail sectors. Our friends at Bloomberg and Reuters in London and New York make sense of the latest markets, business and economic data.
I try to avoid the term perfect storm, but it applies so well here that I can't avoid using it.
They have a lot of difficulties to actually bring the two parties together. And on top of that, in recent weeks, we are witnessing infighting between rebels themselves in northern Syria. So there are a lot of different clashes within this.
And of course, a Monocle editor drops into the studio to review the papers across North and South America. That's The Briefing, every weekday at noon London time, 7 a.m. East Coast, here on Monocle 24.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It is a beautiful brand that it's all about giving the consumer the best possible product. We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
We put a shingle on the door, so to speak, which said brand strategy company 25 years ago, and people thought we were just mad poets and really didn't get what we were about.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana, the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
You get obsessed about the details. And if you're making the same product day in, day out, you build this incredible product that is very difficult to replicate.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
You're tuned in to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck. Now, how to improve the design of the world around us? It's fair to say a bit of a preoccupation for us here at Monocle. And one organisation has, for the best part of a century, taken up that very cause by awarding the very best in student design aimed at improving the lives we lead through reimagining the built environment around us.
The Royal Society of the Arts here in London and their annual student awards have been awarding the very best in new design, from toilets to bus shelters, from washing machines to turnstiles in underground stations, for 90 years this year. Well, joining us in the studio now is Sevra Davis, Associate Director of Design at the Royal Society of the Arts, or the Royal Society of Arts, I believe. I'm just about to give you an extra word there, here in London.
For free, Andrew.
And also the manager of the Student Design Awards. Now, the Royal Society of Arts. Just explain before we dive into the awards. There's so many institutions in London with Royal at the beginning and Arts at the end. Explain the history of your organisation.
Yes, of course. So I'm actually going to delve even deeper, which is that the full title is the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufactures and Commerce. I think that title says it all to some degree. It's born out of the Enlightenment, but it's really thinking about how we can improve society using those three things. Arts, if you think about creative processes. Manufactures means that there's still a need that we make things and that there are tangible outputs. And finally, commerce is sort of how it all comes together and how things are brought to market.
But you kind of need that full title, because otherwise I imagine there's people knocking at your doors thinking they're going to see the odd Vermeer or Holbein or something, and it's
yes.
Not about that.
Yes, we're not the RCA, nor are we the Royal Academy, for any confusion.
Go away.
But having said that, the RSPMDC is not an acronym.
We're neither Royal Sun Alliance either. Anyway.
Insurance company.
No. And has through the history, I mean, your design awards and through the history of the organisation as a whole, have they reflected that idea, that kind of leaning towards manufacturing commerce, practicality of design rather than the ephemerality of it?
Absolutely. So the RSA, the Royal Society of the Arts, was founded in 1754. And in 1924, we set up the design awards to reward the best emerging designers. And I think it's safe to say that this scheme itself in the 90 years has not only mirrored the evolution of design from the traditional industrial arts to actually 21st century's understanding of design, which is design thinking, service design, all of the new models. And so the scheme is really has mirrored that, but also helped to lead that evolution.
And cut to this year, how many categories of awards did you give out?
There were 8 briefs, as we call them, this year, and they are all issue-based. They ranged from a brief about how can we better design the working conditions of the future, to how can design play a role in water scarcity issues, particularly in urban environments, to how can we be more resourceful in developing countries and use frugal innovation.
And the participating students are all UK-based, and are they mainly at design colleges, and what do they win?
So to answer the first part of your question, they're not all UK-based. I'd say about 90% are UK-based, but the competition is open to anyone in the world, and I can talk a little bit about our international work in a moment. And in terms of what they win either a cash prize or...
Oh, yes, please.
Yes. Or an internship. Surprisingly, the internships are a lot more valuable.
Okay.
And those range from design agencies, Pentagram, Springitz, Dragon Rouge, Priestman Good, to places that you might not think that they'd be willing to take a designer, such as water companies, the Environment Agency, the Home Office. These are all places that we've worked with in the past. And they also get 1 year free fellowship of the RSA, in addition to the other work that the RSA does. We're a membership organization, and so it allows access to the building and lots of the other resources that the RSA offers.
And it sounds like a fascinating thing to judge and to look at all the submissions coming in, because presumably designs year on year, decade by decade, especially with such a long history as yours, paint a picture of the state of the world, the state of the nation. What were the preoccupations now? Some very environmental and sustainability focused. What were they back in the mid-1920s? was like, we must have a flying car or something. I mean, I wonder whether you can you can see people's predilections, the predilections of a society through the designs of the years.
Yes. I mean, I think there has certainly been an element of seeing the way that design has evolved from decorative arts through to a force for social impact. I think I said that earlier. And so we are now seeing young designers who might be trained in graphic design actually use their skills to enter a service design project. We at present are very concerned with the circular economy and cradle-to-cradle manufacturing and how designers can play a more important role in that. A lot of the decisions that affect a product's end of life actually happen early on in the design stage. So that's something we think a lot about.
In terms the opposite of inbuilt obsolescence.
Absolutely. Yeah. In terms of what those issues were in the 1920s or even in the post-war period.
Sarah's making a face like she might be guessing.
Yeah. I think I'm not going to say anything about that. I will say that some of our most illustrious alumni include Sir Jonathan Ive, Senior Vice President for Design at Apple, who designed some remarkable sort of interface type things back in the 1980s. So we can certainly see a precursor to some of the things that we're so familiar with today.
Well, take us through a couple of the winners this year, what they designed and kind of why they appealed to the judges.
Okay, I'm just going to think quickly. Well, we ran a brief this year together with Waitrose about sustainable packaging. Actually, what is the role of packaging? A lot of packaging goes to waste. How can packaging either be better recycled, or can we use packaging for another use after it's used to carry the goods safely from shop to home, if you were? And one student actually looked at the whole issue of paint and paint containers. Short life paint containers are a surprisingly big issue. The fact that paint dries out quickly after you buy it and paint one thing. So he designed a whole system around how we could have better paint containers, what the branding on that would be, and actually designed a new nozzle system for that. So it doesn't actually sound that exciting probably when I describe it, but the impact on what it would mean for business and for the environment is actually quite huge. And that was a student, Alec Machin, from the University of Nottingham.
And do you hope that these ideas will be picked up by the likes of Waitrose? And is there some appetite on the behalf of those companies to do that?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's growing more and more. So we are finding that, and I often say this when I go to the universities and speak to students, which is that this isn't about a student competition. The way of the world is changing, and the idea that you submit into this might become your career. You might find that you become an entrepreneur developing paint containers, if that's what you choose to do. And we're putting more and more mechanisms in place, mentoring and business support for these students, so that if they appetite is there, they can go on and take these ideas to market.
And do you guys at the RSA have a good relationship with, I mean, you mentioned these internships that people can go and do at these big design firms and things. Do you have a very good relationship with them? Are you sort of a bit of a bridge between the design student and the workplace and the future of design?
Absolutely. So not only a bridge between education and the design industry, but education and the role of design in industry as a whole. So as organizations like the Cabinet Office or the Environment Agency, government organizations and other organizations, as I mentioned before, some water companies that we work with that have never traditionally looked to designers are actually starting to see the value of that by working with us in the Student Design Awards. And so there's something there as organizations seek innovation in new ways that they're looking for emerging designers and the thinking that they bring with them.
And tell us, for listeners around the world who want to now go and see these kind of 8 amazing ideas, how can they do that?
So, go to my web address, right?
Well, you can give a web address is always handy at this point.
Yes, so...
this is where, when some guests say available in all good bookshops.
Right.
Fear not the plug.
you can't buy anything in a bookshop, I'm afraid. And this is where I have to test my memory if I can remember our website. If you go to sda.thersa.org, that should take you to the right place, and I'm sure it will.
But that's the Royal Society of Arts. That's the key.
RSA Student Design Awards, good. Yeah.
Well, Sarah Davis, thank you very much for joining us from the Royal Society of Arts. I'm intrigued about the 8 briefs.
Yes, you like briefs.
The world's best underpants designer. That's got to be a winner. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for your time. Thank you.
Monocle 24 is your 24-hour-a-day international radio service, based in the heart of London with contributions from our bureau in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York, Toronto and Zurich, and reporters in more than 30 countries. We broadcast a mix of news, discussion, features, reportage, reviews, music and more. From retail to travel, food to urbanism, business to film, Monocle 24 has it covered.
One of the things that I would like to allude to, which is very much the kind of thing that you're doing here, is you're having this kind of discussion. But the discussion that needs to take place, where the forward thinking needs to come from, is from the brains trusts and the think tanks, and they're not doing it.
To call it an international conference, that's difficult in itself. The really difficult thing is then to start to implement the conclusions.
I was actually the last correspondent to send dispatches by carrier pigeon. It's not something I'm proud of.
There are two kinds of games. The games that uses the city, and the other kind is the city that uses the games.
Plus, our carefully curated playlist is the soundtrack to your day, stretching from Stockholm to Sydney, Brooklyn to Bogota.
It was like entering the gates of heaven.
You can hear us live at monocle.com, catch up with anything you may have missed on our Time Shift player, download our bespoke app for your smartphone, and hear it all on iTunes.
I like the sense that you just have no idea where it's going to go.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The menu isn't just about food or drinks. It's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savor traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender traveling the world in search of new and exciting flavors, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
As well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hipp, before the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
And this is the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. Now, this might be a tough sell for the radio, but we're delving into the world of silent theatre next on the Weekly. The Mum & Chance Theatre Company was founded in Paris in 1972, and in the 40 years since has reshaped concepts of physical theatre, melding visual comedy, puppetry and pantomime.
Well, the company is preparing itself for a forthcoming European tour, and I'm delighted to say that joining us now from the company's base in Altstetten, Switzerland, is Floriana Frazetto, one of the founding members of the Mum & Chance Theatre Company. Floriana, thank you very much for coming onto the radio. Now, just explain to us exactly how you describe, when you meet people at a nice kind of cocktail do in Switzerland, what you actually do. Do you describe it as being a puppet master, as an actress? How do you see yourself?
I see myself like, a modern version of commedia dell'arte, where the masks are done with everyday poor materials, whether plastic or toilet paper or foam rubber or cardboard or wood, many objects already existing, everyday life objects that we use in our households or at home, and that we recycle and bring them with little vignettes, little stories that are understood worldwide by any culture, which have a very subtle humor, a very subtle criticism, and that everyone enjoys, you know, and then somehow the simplicity of the visual narration is strong and a bit abstract, and therefore people seem to never forget it, you know. Sometimes we are outside the theater after the show and there are people waiting and they said, you know, I saw you 30 years ago and here I'm bringing my grandchildren. some years ago I used to get offended. But now I find it extraordinary to have four or five generations in the hall, and they are all enjoying it. Because occasionally, you know, shows which are aimed for the family or more likely for children are a bit perhaps boring for adults, but this aims to the child in all of us, from 6 to 106.
And is that presumably the trick, Floriana, that theatre is one of the things, it should be an essential thing that kind of unlocks our inner child, and we don't know we're thinking about something, but we're finding it entertaining. How do you do it in terms of a wordless theatre? How do you replicate the memory of sort of to be or not to be in other great lines? Did you expect people to take away a movement or a particular scene that they can remember in the same way that they might remember a memorable line?
Well, the stories are so simple. Like, I will make you an example. There is the first blob, and it's rolling about the stage. And then it feels this obstacle, and it wants to go on top of this obstacle, which is a rostrum. And so it starts trying to find its balance. And then finally, it conquers itself within the balance. And it's so happy, it's jumping up and down. And by jumping up and down, it slides away. You know, it's that moment like when we were very small children and we were trying to reach for the jam, right? And then we were trying, and then, boom, we fell, for instance. But the emotions of it are understood from Tehran to Santiago de Chile to Rome, Italy, and I'm sure in London, with the great sense of humor you have, you will enjoy it.
And Floriana, tell me, it strikes me as you talk about it, in a way it's on the same kind of a smaller scale than, say, something like Cirque du Soleil, or it also reminds me a little bit of Mr. Bean in a sense. You know, these are products that have been created which any culture can get. They're kind of not dependent on language. Over the years, have you been very careful to make sure that you've always stayed in that territory, or have you been tempted in the past to think, actually, I'd like to speak to the audience more, to use language?
We have been performing now over 40 years, and Cirque du Soleil didn't exist. I think even one of the founders did an audition for us at some point in New York. So, you know, it's a second phase of our type of work. And Mr. Bean, I don't know how long he has been doing it, but he does a wonderful job, and I'm, of course, the first fan of Mr. Bean. I try to be careful when he's on, because I still laugh. Even though I've seen some of his sketches 15 times, I still enjoy them like for the first time. Of course, it's fantastic when one finds his own language, and the passion is such to want to communicate and share the communication and the stories and the emotions, that of course they will become grand, you know, such as Mr. Bean. Cirque du Soleil, I think it's fantastic, but for me it's, how would I say, it's too baroque. You know, I like more the abstraction. I like to see one person at a time or two people on stage. I think less is more. This is our motto. So in this respect, we're very different, but I'm full of admiration for their work, for sure. You know, it's they made their own choice. We were, how would I say, asked to go to Las Vegas, but we didn't quite find it the kind of place for us. We would rather go to Las Vegas, but off Las Vegas, to the university, and perform for the students or for families. But I think the Las Vegas act is not really our cup of tea, as you would say. But, you know, we like this intimacy. There is some strength. And what is extraordinary is that nowadays, even though we should be born only with two fingers, because why do we need the other fingers for, right? So even though we are in this wonderful communication of internet and Facebook and blog and whatever, people still enjoy to have the quietness, the simplicity, the purity of the emotion, because they can imagine, they can invent. They're not being told what to think and what to feel. They can just be free and create also with us, along with us. And of course, every show is different because you never know what kind of mix there is out there. So, yeah, what can I tell you? It's every day, it's still fresh, even though it's 42 years, you know, and I hope for the next 20 at least.
And Floriana, tell us just briefly before we finish, Andrew's last question about Cirque du Soleil, Mr. Bean. It seems like that Moomin Chance has come from, does it come from an intellectual base, or does it come from a purely kind of joyful, performative base? You know what I mean? I mean, there's a great history, an intellectual history of European theatre, which this seems to kind of be the root of, rather than, as you said, the Baroque excesses or something like Cirque du Soleil.
Well, we come from 68, right? Mm, yeah. Andres and Bernie, my two co-founding members, colleagues, studied at Le Coq in Paris, which is a mime, movement, acrobatic, and mask school. I studied Commedia dell'arte in Rome and did a mime school. And when the three of us joined forces, we had to open that little poor suitcase rich of ideas and of wanting to say this and criticize that and break down the society and the miscommunication of mankind, you know, with whatever we found and whatever we could have for practically 2 cents, because we wanted to change the world. Never did we think that we would end up on Broadway for 3 years.
That's a good answer. I think that encapsulates the enduring success of Moomin Chance. Floriana, lovely speaking to you. That was Floriana Frazzetto, one of the founding members of Moomin Chance Theatre Company. And what are we going to do next, Andrew? We're going to say goodbye, I think, aren't we?
Okay, goodbye.
Well, there we go. What are you going to be chilling for the World Cup final? Some South Tyrolean wine? Well,
that would be nice, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it be good?
They sell it now in the Monaco Cafe.
I'm sure it's 7-1. Oh, do we? Do we sell,
yes,
it? Sell it in the Monaco Cafe?
I think they've even got a few
beers
in there as well.
Beer in there as well, yeah. I wonder if it would be as nice in a bottle as it will from the Pression.
And whether it would be as nice without a mountain behind you. We could do a cutout for you. But it's quite nice. It's quite...
Blow on me a bit.
Context is all, I think.
Context is all. Yeah, that's always the thing, isn't it, with things like that, whether or not you really do need to be... Also, whether you would need to have 20 of them. Well,
did you really love
that was
it,
quite
or
a
did
long...
you love the fact you had 20 of them?
No, exactly. It could mean anything by the end. Exactly. Anyway, we've let ourselves down there. We were very well behaved. It was good.
No, we were on top form.
We went for a drink afterwards, didn't we, to a bar, I think largely to toast the birthday of Emily Smith.
Yes, who's our PR, who's our in-house press manager. And we went to the Hotel Lauren.
Is that where we went?
Yes, Hotel Lauren.
I love that huge Stonehenge thing. I wanted to go and lie on that because I was a bit tired by that point.
Yeah, they had a drinking table. It was like a huge slab of, you know, granite.
Yeah, it was amazing. Anyway, enough of that.
Okay, we've done our bit for sutural tourism.
Oh, yeah, I think we have. We've got to pick our next destination, Andrew, where we want to be the best behaved people at the party. Maybe a WI tea and cake morning.
Okay, I'll come with you.
Shall we thank the people behind the glass?
Let's do.
Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. We'll be here again, same time, same place, but a different week. Next week. For the time being, for me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.